Craig and Fred, the story of a Marine, the dog he met while serving in Afghanistan, and how they saved each other. Author Craig Grossi has a remarkable tale to tell, not only about what it was like to do intelligence work as a Marine in Helmand Province of Afghanistan, but also how he rescued a stray dog from there, and then how the dog rescued him as he faced post-traumatic stress after his service. Grossi's new book about his journey is out in both adult and young adult versions and is receiving national attention. He lives in Maine now, with Fred the dog still by his side. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will meet Craig and Fred and hear this story that begins in a war zone and ends here in Maine. It includes dangerous missions and a cross-country road trip. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Craig Grossi was stationed in Afghanistan when he met a dog he describes as goofy-looking and unlike other strays he had seen in the war-torn country. Little did he know at the time that this goofy-looking dog would play a huge role in his life. Today, Craig Grossi and his dog Fred are in the studio with me. Craig is an 8-year veteran of the Marine Corps, recipient of the Purple Heart, and Georgetown University graduate. He is the author of Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other, which is out in both an adult and young adult version. As always, we want to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. It's such a pleasure to have you here, Craig. I feel like I know you after reading the book. I bet you get that a lot, don't you?
Yeah. That's a sign that I did an okay job of just sharing our story and kind of how we came together and where we're going now. And yeah, so that's always cool to hear.
And I'm
really
thrilled not only to have you in the studio, but to have Fred in the studio. Yeah. And he is just as cute in person and not goofy looking, as you say.
Yeah, so, I know. I like to give him a hard time.
But I want to start at the beginning about when you were graduating from high school and enlisted in the Marines. Mm-hmm. Why'd you enlist in the Marines?
There's a lot of reasons. And I mean, I can't really fall back on like my family or anything. Like we weren't really a military family. My dad served in the Air Force, but it was when he was a young man. And I think for me, it was really just kind of they didn't seem like they wanted me or like they needed me, the Marine Corps. And when I talked to all the other branches, they seemed to kind of have a different approach. They gave you a lot of reasons to join and a lot of different. It's kind of almost like they were selling you on it. And when I talked to the Marine Corps or when I interacted with the Marine, it was always just this kind of, you know, it's something that you have to choose to do. And it's a path that is harder and it's harder for a reason. And I was really, I think it was a lot of, you know, just I felt like I'd kind of flown under the radar my whole life and I wanted to be held accountable. And I wanted to be around people who were better than me. And the Marine Corps seemed to really kind of have that. That element to it that I was really craving. So and I was kind of tired of getting away with everything. I wanted to be to kind of get my butt kicked a little bit.
It's an interesting thing for a 17 or 18 year old boy to say. I was tired of getting away with stuff and wanted to get my butt kicked.
Yeah, you know, I think it was really just you know, a standard. The standards are higher for the Marine Corps in a lot of ways, and that's really ultimately what, you know, if I was going to commit years of my life to something, I wanted it to be, you know, something I could really be proud of. And yeah.
So you became a recon Marine doing intelligence work. And this is, there's so many things that I found were fascinating. But tell me, once you were in Afghanistan, describe to us how you did your work. How did you do this intelligence gathering?
Yeah. And first, that's a common thing. I wasn't actually a recon Marine. I was an intelligence collector attached to recon, which it's fine. That happens. But It's a confusing thing because within the military, and specifically on deployments like the one I was on, you have a team of recon guys or infantry troops, and they have different attachments like explosive ordnance, civil affairs, engineers that do different jobs that the infantry guys don't necessarily do. Fred's talking right now. Hey, buddy. All right. And so what I brought was intelligence collection and specifically intelligence gathered from people. And so that was just my specialty that I brought to the battlefield that the recon guys couldn't necessarily provide for themselves.
Right. So you would go out in patrols at night. I mean,
yeah.
First of all, it sounds terrifying, but, you know, it's just so interesting that you really just walked up to people and started talking to them. You had no idea who these people were.
No, I mean, the area we went into had been loosely held, if held all, by coalition forces throughout the entire course of the conflict. And a lot of the issues and the kind of questions we had going in were just, what do they call this place? Like, there was no name for a cluster of villages on a map. And so if nothing else, it was my job to just figure out what they called their village or what tribe they were affiliated with or anything like that. And so, it was really an awesome experience for me to be able to spend so much time with villagers. I feel like my friends that have deployed, you know, haven't necessarily gotten that same amount of time. And I really, really valued that exposure to them. It was really, they're really special people.
And I was going to say, what did you think of the Afghan people you met?
Yeah, they're just wonderful. And I wanted what was best for them. I wanted them to live their life just, you know, in the simple ways that we take for granted every day, just freedom of movement and the freedom to accumulate more than a week's worth of food without having to worry about somebody coming to take it, you know, and because that's kind of what they were communicating to me was like, if we stay in one place for more than a week and we accumulate, you know, too much stuff, then we're, you know, somebody will just come up, show up and take it. The Taliban will just come and take our stuff. And so they were almost like refugees in their own country, and they were moving around from little village to little village, just working when they could. And so they brought us in, you know, at night with open arms and would make us tea. And it was like, I felt, you know, just really compelled to do as much as I could to give them, you know, at least a sliver of security and kind of stability.
Mm. How'd you meet Fred?
Yeah, so Fred was one of the kind of contingencies with operating the way we were was there was no base for us to go to. So we inserted out of helicopters at night, and we had designated a couple of compounds that looked like they might be good in terms of being able to live in them for a couple of weeks. And so me and my interpreter walked up to this one, and there had been a family in there for a couple of days, and we talked to them and kind of helped them move to a different compound that would be a little bit safer. And we spent the rest of the night filling sandbags and just trying to fortify this little house that we had kind of taken over. And then the next morning, we were surrounded by 150, 200 plus fighters, and we spent 7 days, just kind of fighting for our lives and trying to beat back the enemy. And they were coming at us with mortars and rockets and all kind of different stuff that we hadn't seen in a coordinated manner that nobody had seen. And in between all of that and in between all the crazy stuff was Fred. And I would catch little glimpses of him here and there when I would be having, you know, a drink of water or just taking a break from what was going on. And I always just – he immediately caught my eye and caught the eye of the other guys I was with, because he was out during the day, which you didn't see a lot of dogs out during the day. It was so hot. And he was kind of a loner. You didn't see him hanging around with other dogs. And he had this confident little trot that he had, and he just kind of putzed around the compound. And it looked like he owned the place, you know. And so when things calmed down, I had to check him out. I had to walk over and see what was going on with him. We've been together ever since.
Now, well, this is interesting because you could have gotten in big trouble for hanging out with a dog, right? Why? What are the military rules about stray dogs when you're deployed, and why are they so strict?
Because, you know, it's a tough situation, and it is honestly a good rule. You can't have everybody going up, because if it had gone a different way and I had walked up to Fred and he had bit me and broke the skin, I would have had to have then been probably medically evacuated to get back to the rear to get checked for rabies and all that stuff. And then you're talking about, you know, a guy off the front lines and then all the resources that it takes to take me back, you know. And it's not something that you want everybody walking up and doing. But in the case of Fred, you know, he was so special and so different. And so it was just such a natural kind of thing that, you know, I didn't have a problem kind of bending the rules and approaching him. But right off the bat, they tell us when we get in the country, you know, don't approach any stray animals. And this is why. And I had never planned on, on doing it. But that's just the way life goes. Sometimes you get opportunities to.
Well, Fred had a way, it sounds like, of recruiting allies, even like commanding officers and things.
Fred is good at getting his way. He's made that very clear to me and to everybody else. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even our apartment that I got when I got home from Afghanistan, I only got it because it was across the street from a dog park, you know, and I knew he would need to be outside a lot. And, you know, we were living in the city, but at least I could be able to take him off leash and get him outside as much as I could. And yeah, so that's just lots of little funny ways, but in a lot of big ways, he's made my life so much better. So that's great.
Well, you talk about in the book, there was one time when he may have indeed put your life in danger when you took him out on patrol with you.
Yeah. Yeah. He came on patrols and we never had a problem with it because he understood that we were quiet. And because the way we were patrolling was we were just trying, there were so many villagers kind of caught in the middle in this area called Green Zone. And we were trying to get to them at night. And that was the only safe time. That was the safest time for us to talk to them, because if the Taliban ever saw them talking to us, they would be in trouble. And so our goal was to really just engage with them and see if they would follow us out and get them out of the battle space, because that was one less family that the Taliban could use to hide behind to shoot at us. And so we would go out at night in these little teams, and the risk was big, because if the Taliban kind of got wind of where we were, they could launch a little ambush on us. But so we were wary about having Fred come along, but he figured out really quickly that, you know, we were quiet and, you know, that he needed to be quiet too. And, even other stray dogs would be barking at us when we would walk through a village, and he wouldn't bark back, and he would just kind of creep along. And it was almost like he was hurting us through some of these situations, which was pretty funny. But there was one night in particular when he got the scent of two Taliban IED emplacers hiding under a blanket in a field just the next field over from our patrol, and there was no stopping his bark in that situation. And so after that, we decided to make him stay back when we went on patrol.
And he ended up staying with
Top. Yeah. And Top. And yeah. When you read the book, Top is an outstanding character for any story. But in to me, he's just an incredible person. And I'm so grateful to have served alongside him and to know him, you know, as a friend now. And I was just really proud to share his stories in particular, because he's had an incredible career in service to our country. And I'm proud to have spent a little bit of time with him, you know, and of all his deployments and all the places he's been. Yeah.
Well, we're talking with Craig Grossi. He's the author of Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Craig, you were hurt in Afghanistan. You received a brain injury. What happened?
Yeah, it was really couldn't have gotten much closer. We were one of the other things we started to do was once the Taliban kind of gave us a little bit more breathing room, we pushed out and we would try to take over a compound in the Green Zone and hold it for a day or two, and just try to demonstrate, you know, that, you know, we were advancing into the Taliban territory and really demonstrate to the villagers that we were serious about taking ground and holding ground and giving them that freedom of movement back. And so we took this one compound and we saw some sporadic kind of fighting in the morning, but nothing too bad. And I had spent most of the morning kind of talking to villagers that had just walked up and wanted to talk and just talking to them about their life and what it was like and their concerns. After I got done talking to a little group of villagers, I went and took a nap in a little breezeway. And as soon as I kind of dozed off, I just felt this big thud right behind me. It turned out to be a 107 millimeter anti-tank rocket that they're just kind of laying around all over there. And they're meant to be fired from a big gun, but they usually, the way the Taliban fires them is they prop them up and hit them with a hammer. And we usually laugh at them because they kind of go out of control and they sputter off into the sky, and they're not super accurate. But I guess these guys were managed to get kind of close enough to us that it was a pretty straight shot right into our compound, and it landed just on the other side of a little mud wall, and blew the whole wall down on me. And it was kind of, I think my injury was specifically, you know, what kind of knocked me out was the blast wave. And then I had a bunch of stuff hit me in the back of the head. So I had like some big contusions on the back of my head. But it was tough for me because I grew up playing hockey and I grew up just generally kind of being a knucklehead, getting smacked around a lot. So I'd had my share of bumps on the head, and it was hard for me to take it seriously for a really long time. I got my Purple Heart in the mail. I didn't even want to kind of ceremoniously get it because to me, it just didn't seem like, you know, I was worthy of that medal. So, but now, you know, talking to people and realizing, you know, the how much research hasn't been done on concussions and specifically, you know, blast wave concussions and what happens to the brain when it's, you know, hit with a wave like that. So, you know, I think it's just another kind of example of you know, an opportunity for me to rise up and you know, and get past it and stay strong and keep moving. And Fred, you know, Fred has been a huge part of that for me and keeping me positive. And I talk about it in the book a little bit, just what I call now stubborn positivity and making, you know, when it's so easy to be negative, and just like Fred could have been, you know, in his life before I came along, you know, he could have reacted negatively. He could have been like all the other dogs that we saw, but he chose to be positive. And that has made, you know, all the difference in his life, and it's been an example to me of when we have that choice, when we could react negatively and choose to let the world kind of shape, you know, our stance. You know, if we choose to be stubbornly positive, then, you know, there's a lot more opportunities there.
Well, I want to talk more about stubborn positivity. I also want to hear, we haven't even gotten to the part of the story where you get Fred out of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And we have to talk about that too.
Definitely.
But we don't have time before the break, so we're going to hold that for after the break. We're talking with Craig Grossi, the author of Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other. Please join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. talk@mainpublic.org is the email address, tweet @MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does New England Cancer Specialists. 50 years of working toward better outcomes for Maine patients. Learn more at newenglandcancerspecialists.org.
Hurricane Irma leveled trailer parks and devastated affordable housing in the Florida Keys. Now officials worry that's turned a longstanding problem into a crisis.
Police officers, firefighters, nurses, teachers, if those folks can't find places to live, they're going to have to move someplace else.
A housing crunch in the Keys this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can tune in to All Things Considered this afternoon and every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio. Well, this summer, Maine Public Travel is going to Iceland. It's an island nation known for its black sands, midnight sun, and unique culture. If you've ever thought about visiting Iceland, you can join us from June 17th through June 23rd. We'll see natural wonders like geothermal pools and spectacular waterfalls, and our own Jennifer Rooks will host a talk show at Roof. That's Iceland's public broadcasting organization. For more information, visit mainpublic.org and click education, or call 1-877-479-7040. Again, that's 1-877-479-7040. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the story of Marine veteran Craig Grossi and his dog, Fred. With me in the studio are Craig and Fred. Craig Grossi is an 8-year veteran of the Marine Corps, recipient of the Purple Heart, and Georgetown University graduate. He is the author of Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other. Our other guest, who is not on mic, is a dog. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org. tweet @MainCalling or post to our Facebook page. We have a Facebook post from Susan. She says, thank you for sharing stubborn positivity wherever you both go. I saw you at my local library recently.
Oh, cool.
And gave your book to my daughter and relatives for Christmas. Love hearing you again and seeing Fred in the studio.
Oh, that's so awesome.
That's great. Thank you, Susan, for writing
it. Thank you.
So here we go. How on earth, when you were not supposed to have a dog,
yeah,
did you get a dog out of Afghanistan? It's not, you know, there are not regularly scheduled flights in which you can, you know, just put them in a kennel.
No. Yeah. And this was, you know, I guess it's really just the, you know, shows the power of, you know, of a dog, you know, not, and because I certainly did not do it alone. There were so many people, from my sister back home in the States to, you know, to the workers from the DHL shipping service on Camp Leatherneck, and you know, some Marines that kind of pitched in at the last minute, and you know, just people that were encouraging me, you know, that knew about what was going on. Like the recon guys couldn't do a lot, but they, you know, they were rooting for me, and that I think, you know, is something I should have touched on a little bit more in the book, but I want them to know, you know, like that was huge, because if I had thought, you know, my fellow Marines were like, what's this guy doing? He's nuts. Like, it's just a dog, or, you know, like what? But if they had kind of, you know, kind of tried to bring that down, I might have been a little bit more discouraged. But
so you had a whole network of people, or Fred had a whole network of people quietly and sort of under the radar working on his behalf.
Yeah. And as a, you know, as a former or back then a current intelligence, you know, guy, that the gray area is kind of where we really do you know, a lot of our work, and that's, you know, that's what I had to do, you know, to get Fred home, was really find those avenues that aren't exactly obvious, you know, and just some of the you know, more resourceful natures that you know you learn in intelligence training, and just you know, ultimately bringing Fred around and introducing him to people, and people could see immediately that he was a special dog, and he needed to get home. So that was, you know, it's a really awesome part of the book, and you really see, you know, just the power of that connection with animals, because the DHL workers were from different African countries, the Philippines, Indonesia, and they were working. They worked really hard. They had their own little compound on Camp Leatherneck. And they, you know, they were just unloading and loading trucks all day from the flight line. And, you know, they were away from their families, working for better money than they could have made back home, but still, you know, a really low wage. And they lived and worked and ate right in that compound. And then here comes this dog, you know, and they too could have gone either way. They could have been like, what, you know, like, we're not taking this dog. We're not going to do anything for this dog. And we're too busy. We're too tired. We're too hungry, you know, but they took one look at Fred and you know, and they loved him immediately, and I, you know, I barely had to ask, you know, for them to watch him, because the other thing was I was back at Leatherneck for 2 weeks.
Right, you weren't done.
No, and we were just taking a break, and we were going back into the field, and so yeah, they volunteered to take care of him for me while I went back out, and that was when I got hit with the rocket and had to come back, and even that ended up being a little fortuitous, because I came back earlier and was able to get Fred home after I got out of the hospital. So yeah, it was a lot of people working on a lot of different kind of avenues, and it just kind of came together. I still can't believe it sometimes.
So you sent Fred back to the States, and your sister took care of him, mm-hmm. but you were still stationed in Afghanistan. In fact, really the worst part of your deployment came after that.
Yeah. That was when we shifted our operations in the green zone and really concentrated on more sustained kind of efforts in trying to hold ground that, you know, we had kind of been coming and going from. And so instead of flying out in helicopters, we drove, and it took days to get out there from Leatherneck, but because we kept hitting IEDs or just hitting different problems. But once we got out there, we established a base, and really we wanted to show, you know, the villagers and everybody that was there that, you know, that we weren't leaving, and that we were making this area, you know, a priority. But that came with, you know, with a lot of challenges. And that was when, you know, when we started patrolling even more, you know, you just open yourself up to risks. And that was, you know, that was when we started to lose some really awesome guys.
And people you were very close to.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was Sean, I had known just for a couple of days. I talk a lot about Sean in the book, but he's one of those guys that you can meet him for, you could know him for 5 minutes or 5 years, and he's, you know, you're never going to forget him. He went above and beyond the call of duty for us that day, and he just knew, you know, that we needed him to be on that roof and to do what he did, and And just one of the most genuine and humble guys you'll ever meet. And then Justin that same night was just an incredible guy. And just being on that patrol was above and beyond his call of duty, because EOD, you know, by definition, they don't really have to patrol. They
EOD?
Explosive Ordnance Disposal. Mm-hmm. So they traditionally all they really need to do is kind of hang out back at the base. And then if the patrol comes across an IED, because everybody's pretty much basically trained in IED detection, then we could call EOD and they come and they dispose it. But Justin and his partner Issa, you know, they weren't the type of Marines to kind of hang back. They wanted to be there, and they knew that that's how they could best serve, you know, their fellow Marines. So they were on patrol with us. And, you know, one of the last things Justin said to us was, you know, I'm not going to send that young Marine up there to sweep over this bridge, because he knew there would be an IED on it. Excuse me. Sorry, I think I got a Fred hair in my nose. and so he said, if we send him up there, we'll be sending him up there to die. And Justin took his place and decided to go up on the bridge and look for the IED. And he found it. But it was confusing. It was nighttime and it was dark, and the bridge wasn't very big. It was just a little mud bridge, maybe more than a foot and a half wide. And he triggered the IED, and we did, you know, the corpsman that was with us did an incredible job to try and keep him stable. But it was, you know, really, we were actually taking fire from the Taliban that night, just sporadic kind of sniper fire that was, keeping our heads down. And then the medevac bird, you know, that's a tricky thing for them to land into an active gunfight. And so it just, everything took longer than it should have. And the mud really slowed us down. And, you know, those are scenes in the book that were hard to write, but really important for me to write, because I feel like their stories are really important.
Right. You wrote them in the book, mm-hmm. and now you're on a book tour. So you're telling it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, what's that like for you? I'm asking you about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's important. For a long time, I kind of shoved it down, and I thought, you know, the best I can do is to just live a good life and kind of bury myself in work and really, you know, every Memorial Day, just think about them. But now I'm realizing that the story with Fred and how I got him home is an opportunity to talk not just about Fred and our relationship, but about these people that I served with, and specifically Sean and Justin, and shed light on, you know, their actions that night and that day. Our story is so much bigger than me and Fred. I think that's what really motivated me to write it at all. Because if it had just been, you know, about a guy and his dog, we got enough of those. You know, there's a lot of books about stuff like that. And I think, you know, I would have never felt comfortable just writing about myself. I really needed it to be bigger than me. You know, as hard as it is to talk about those guys and some of that stuff, you know, that's why we're here. You know, and I think that you know, it's an important part of where we're at now.
When you came home from Afghanistan, you enrolled in college in Georgetown. First of all, how much time passed between that horrible battle and when you were suddenly finding yourself on a college campus as a student? Was it a year later?
It was a like maybe almost 2 years later, because
okay.
I came home and I got out almost immediately, and because I had extended to stay when I went on that deployment. And then I gave a government kind of intelligence job in the DC area. I gave it a shot for a little over a year, and I didn't like it. I wasn't happy, and I didn't really see it going anywhere. And then I got into Georgetown somehow and decided to just, after my first semester taking classes part time, I was like, this is where I'm supposed to be. I want to sink myself completely in school. And the more time I spent away from the government and the intelligence world, and the more time I spent really contemplating, you know, what I wanted to do and writing a lot, you know, the more I realized, you know, this is kind of the direction I want to go in.
It's great to hear you say that, because part of me would think that you would, you know, you go from where you're in such a serious, serious place, you know, one of the most dangerous places in the world, doing really important work, to a college campus. And even though Georgetown is a fine and serious college campus, still undergraduates have a completely different mindset than U.S. Marines, most of them. Was that just really strange?
Well, it was and it wasn't, because at the same time, the school itself did a really good job of getting us classes that had other veterans in them.
Oh, interesting.
And so it was very, very few circumstances where I was the only vet in the classroom. Because Georgetown actually is, at least back then, I don't know what the current rankings are, but it was the number one school in the country for veterans. And they've gone above and beyond. I mean, they gave me way more credits than I had ever been offered from the couple of schools I had talked to before, just for my time in military training that I had done. They found reasons to give me credit, which is incredible. A lot of schools don't do that. So, it was funny, and I played on the hockey team at Georgetown, which is really when I got my most exposure to undergrads, was getting to know those guys. But they're really respectful and really hardworking kids, and I was really proud to play hockey with them and get to know them too, and really get to know the generation that's kind of coming up, after us. And I'm proud, proud to know them, and proud to say that they. They definitely had a different mindset about certain things, but they when it came to time to learn, they were ready to do that, and they were always ready to hear stories about my life and stuff like that. So that was awesome.
So the chapters in your book, we've been really talking about this story as though it's a straight line, but the chapters in your book alternate between the story of your military service and also a cross-country road trip you did with your friend Josh. So tell me about Josh.
Yeah, Josh is awesome. He's a really another just amazing guy that's a big part of the story, and another reason that I really felt compelled to share it. I met him at my very first class at Georgetown. It was one of those situations where I was like, I'm going to be walking into a room of 19-year-olds and they're all going to stare at me like, who's this old guy? And I immediately see this other kind of hairy bearded guy in the back with a dusty military looking backpack and a prosthetic leg. And I was like, oh, that's my guy. I'm making a beeline for him. And so I went straight to the back of the classroom and we were instant after that first night of class. We were just instant buddies. And then he graduated actually the year before me, and the road trip kind of fell on my last summer break between my junior and senior year. So I kind of wanted to take that opportunity to really test the story almost, and really see, how it felt to tell the story to different people from all over the country, and also explore and show Fred and some of the places of our own country that I'd never seen. In my mind, I just wanted to see Fred at the Grand Canyon. I wanted to see Fred in Big Sur and with the Redwoods, and see myself there, of course, too. But it was just the more places that we went, and the cooler it kind of seemed to think about where Fred had started, And so when I saw Josh, just at one of our neighborhood bars in D.C., he had graduated, but he was having a hard time getting a job because he continuously had to take time off for follow-up surgeries. On the leg that he was able to keep after the IED blast. And so he was really kind of frustrated. And I was like, hey, man, like, this is an opportunity. You're not working. You don't have to worry about taking time off. Like, let's jump in the truck with me and let's go, And so that was a really awesome addition to the journey. And the two of us, we, three of you. Yeah, the three of us. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The three of us, just really kind of made it up as we went along in the best way possible, and just camping and kind of hiking and exploring and our 88 Land Cruiser that is still running. It's in the parking lot today.
Is it? That's great. I'll have to take a look. Yeah. That's so fun.
Yeah, she's like a character in the book herself. Yeah, she's a tough old truck. But back then it wasn't running as good as it is today. I've been able to put a little bit of work into it, but that thing had no business going from DC to Seattle and back. But she made it. She's tough,
and she's now going through Maine winter, her second Maine winter.
Right. Yeah,
that's great. Well, I want to ask. I still haven't gotten to ask you, Craig, about the idea of how you've rescued each other and how Fred has rescued you. We do have to go to a break in just about a minute. But first, I want to read you this from Trish. She sends an email. Are you going to be autographing your book anywhere soon?
Yeah.
So are any readings or anything coming up
in Maine?
Yeah.
We're working on it. Trish, thanks for your question. We don't have anything firm right now, but we're working on our spring and summer kind of dates.
Okay.
So we'll if you just go on our social media or the website, it's just Fred the Afghan, and specifically on our website, fredtheafghan.com, we list our events. And so once we have one, we put it up there. And then we'll try to post, too. So it's Instagram and Facebook is Fred the Afghan.
Okay, great. And the rest of her email is, how did Fred adapt to Maine weather? I was a VA social worker in Pittsburgh for 20 years and respect veterans immensely. Thank you for your service, Craig.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for working for veterans. That's a really incredible job. And Pittsburgh is a really special city. Fred loves it up here. He loves the cold. It's really, really interesting. I mean, he has a nice coat on him. He's got the kind of like a thicker undercoat. And so I've never seen him shiver, you know, even when the last couple of days when we would go for a quick walk outside, his paws would get kind of frozen, but you know, that he never really seemed uncomfortable with the temperature. And I think it's just, you know, he can play all day. He can be outside all day, even in the summer when it doesn't get too hot up here, you know, it doesn't slow him down. He's a big part of why we're up here, because he loves it so much.
Well, before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. We are going to be learning about fetal alcohol syndrome. It is a leading cause of developmental disabilities, but it is not a topic often discussed. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. Thanks for your support.
On the next Fresh Air.
Sometimes I think I'm cursed because of something that happened before I was even born.
The Disney Pixar film Coco just won the Golden Globe for Best Animated Feature. It takes place in a small Mexican town on the Day of the Dead, the holiday to honor deceased loved ones. We'll talk with the co-writers and co-directors Lee Unkrich and Adrian Molina. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us this afternoon at 2 o'clock for World Affairs. It's a panel discussion on the importance of an independent press to a free and functioning democracy. Again, that's at 2 o'clock in about 20 minutes after Maine Calling, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the story of a unique dog and the veteran who rescued him. In fact, they rescued each other. Mm-hmm. Greg Grossi is the author of Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other. We also have Fred with us in the studio. He's very well behaved.
Yeah, he's napping under the chair over here.
If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Have you had anyone from the Marines say anything to you about the book, about publicizing
that
you snuck a dog out of Afghanistan?
No, because it passed through the Pentagon. I mean, before we could publish, I submitted both the young reader and the adult version to the Pentagon. And so they passed it through with and the people in the office were kind of quietly cheering it on, I think. So, yeah, no, we haven't gotten any backlash from the military.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And there are, you know, when I encountered Fred and when all of our, you know, events took place, it was before there were organizations kind of intact that can really help. There's an organization now called the Puppy Rescue Mission that if you're a U.S. troop, you know, overseas anywhere and you encounter an animal, you can contact them and they'll help you organize, you know, to you know, just the different forms and the money and everything that, you know, that you need to do to get them home. So, you know, that wasn't around back then. And I think that's kind of a good workaround in terms of, you know, that rule that we have to face over there is, you know, if you contact this organization, they can kind of help you, you know, make it a little bit more legitimate and than the way we were able to do it with Fred.
But I want to talk about this. I mean, we've talked about how you rescued Fred. How did Fred rescue you?
Yeah. Fred rescues me, you know, every day. You know, sometimes just looking at him, you know, just kind of makes me happy. You know, and it's kind of weird. I like to watch him eat. You know, I like to watch him drink water. It just makes me kind of peaceful, you know, to know that, you know, he's safe and he has enough to eat and he has enough to drink and he's got multiple places he can sleep. He likes to move around at night. He likes the bed and then the chair and then his dog bed. And, you know, so he likes options. And you know, and then to bigger stuff, to, you know, to just telling his story And in the very beginning, when I first got home and I worked for the government, I threw myself into work and I spent, you know, my days at the office. And then when I would come home, Fred and I would go for a run or we would go for a walk around our neighborhood in D.C. And it was kind of slowly when people would ask me, you know, what kind of dog is that? Because he is a unique looking dog. I would start to tell them, you know, about where I found him and how I got him home. And then the next thing I knew, I was talking to him about Justin and about Sean and about, you know, my injury with the rocket. And, you know, and I didn't know it at the time, but that was huge. And just that, you know, ability to share our story with strangers, you know, on the street, you know, was really, you know, just helpful. And that's a huge way that he's, you know, impacted my life and rescued me. And you know, and I don't know how many people I made late for work, you know, that kind of casually one morning would ask me, you know, hey, what kind of dog is that? You know, and I would launch into this 30-minute story about, you know, how and where I found him. But, you know, it was you know, a huge part of how I've been able to cope with, you know, with my PTS and move on from my time in the military and really kind of reconnect myself with my love of storytelling. Because I think looking back at, you know, when I was a kid, that was one of the first things I ever really was good at. And there were so many nights when my dinner would be cold, you know, because I would be telling my family about, you know, a bike ride I went on or a street hockey game I played or something silly that one of my friends did. But I loved kind of sharing, you know, with people, and I loved drawing a picture, you know, for people with words. And so Fred, you know, that's, I wouldn't be able to do that without Fred. You know, I wouldn't have that you know, that caveat to kind of build off of. And so Fred, you know, and then all the, that's, those are, you know, specific to Fred. But then for those of us that have dogs, you know, there's so many ways that dogs,
yes,
save us every,
yes,
day. And
yes,
they get us outside. You know, there's no such thing as a bad day. They want to go outside. And when it is, you know, when they don't want to go outside, you know, it's a nice thing too, you know. And just having them in our lives, it, you know, enhances everything. And you know, so that, you know, on top of all of our adventures and our story, you know, he is still a dog and he is still a huge, you know, part of my life. He's my first dog, you know, and so I'm seeing, you know, all the benefits to having an animal like a dog in your life.
Okay, well, I'm going to go to an email here. I can't tell who this is from, but it says, can you tell us what Fred looks like? Color, size, short hair, or long to give a visual? Animals are wonderful healers, it sure does appear. Also, what was your process for writing, getting published, etc.? Mm-hmm. Sounds as if it was cathartic for you. Congratulations on persevering, writing, and dealing with life head on.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really great. So yeah, I think what was the first question was kind of, what does he look like?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the best way is if you're close to a computer or you have your phone, just go to Fred the Afghan on Instagram or Facebook or FredTheAfghan.com, and we have tons of pictures of Fred. But I think the best way to describe him physically is, like my dad says, he's two dogs long and one dog tall. He's definitely, you know, and he's white with these brown kind of cattle spots on him. And in the winter, he gets these little Bambi spots kind of all over him because he's got a thicker coat that comes through. And but he's got a kind of a big head and this big chest, and he's you know, got this big tail. He's very proud of his tail, and he's kind of got basset legs. They kind of turn out in the front, and then he's got like little terrier legs in the back. They're real springy. And so yeah, he's definitely a, you know, he's definitely got a lot going on in the gene pool area.
You said people are always asking if he's part corgi.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, he gets that a lot, and that's always funny because I didn't see a lot of corgis running around
Afghanistan.
But I guess the British, you know, that when they were there, you know, a long time ago, the British had you know, corgis with them. So maybe, who knows? You know, it's all one big sloppy gene pool that Fred comes from. But
and how did you get published?
Yeah, so that was, you know, I'd been writing and the story for a couple of years, just kind of on and off, and I had got it to the point, I'd started over probably like four or five times, and my last iteration was like kind of early joint, like 2016 was when I really felt like I had the best version of it. And then I was kind of going back and forth with some friends that you know, had some creative kind of connections and just different, you know, my girlfriend Nora is a musician and she writes music. And so she's really just good at writing and being creative. And so just having people kind of just giving me pointers and just where it needs this and where it needs that really helped. And then it was a matter of once I had everything in place, the proposal and the manuscript and everything, it was just a matter of getting exposure. Because, you know, I'm not a retired general. I'm not a celebrity or an athlete or anything like that. So, you know, it's not – nobody would really care unless – as far as the publishing world is concerned, unless, you know, we had something kind of generate a spark and draw attention to our story. And that was a website called The Dodo, which, if you're not familiar with, is awesome. They just – I mean, if you just click like on Facebook, they will send you uplifting, inspirational animal stories all day. You know,
oh,
it's
my
like
gosh.
Everything from like an elephant that fell in a mud hole that gets pulled out by its mom, you know, to a dog, you know, that's like Fred. And so they ran I was emailing lots of different media outlets back in D.C. trying to get somebody to do a little story on us, and I wasn't really getting anywhere. And then I found The Dodo and heard back from them immediately. And they, this lady named Sarah wrote an awesome article and linked everything to our social media. And then they did a video using all of our social media stuff that we had put up that I think has 100 million views as of
now.
It got 40 million views in a week. And then from there, a person from HarperCollins emailed me and we were off and running. Yeah.
And you've decided to do a young adult version, which is really cool. What are you hoping that middle school age kids get out of your story?
Yeah. You know, I think I hope that they get out of it what they need. I think our story has there's a lot of struggles there. And I think that, you know, people can really you don't have to be a dog lover to appreciate, you know, the decisions that I've made and the kind of the failures that I've had and the frustrations that I've felt. You know, anybody that's going through a transition or a hard time, you know, can really see, you know, kind of how I worked through it and how I didn't in some cases and the lessons that I've learned through that. And so I think, you know, if nothing else, it's just the power of positivity and that it's a choice and that, you know, you can very easily let negative, you know, negative energy and negative people and negative things that happen to you dictate how you approach the world and how you approach challenges and how, you know, you manage your relationships. And that's just a really slippery slope once you start down that road. And if you choose, as hard as it is sometimes, to be positive and to be grateful, you know, it's not going to happen overnight, but the good things will come and the world will give back to you and the positivity will come back to you. And it's, again, it's not a, you know, it's definitely not a how-to book. It's definitely not, you know, it's a story, you know, and I think what I love about it is when people read it, tell me things that they love about it that I could have never anticipated.
Huh.
And that's what I love so much about it is that people are taking away different things that, you know, that I could have never, you know, thought of. And that's huge. You know, so I think if, you know, people will read it and they'll get what they need out of it. And that's what's so important to me.
Mark in Brunswick writes, thank you for your service. I read Outlaw Platoon by Sean Parnell, and he talked about forward operating base Burn Mel having some dogs that troops had found. It sounded like it was an uplifting advantage. Was that commonplace with other bases?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Thanks for your email, man. And it was. There were a lot of fobs that would end up kind of the company that was there for their course of their deployment. They would kind of adopt the dog or a couple of dogs, and they make little houses for them. And I mean, there was nothing like, you know, coming back from a long night patrol, slugging through the mud and talking to villagers all night and knowing that Fred, you know, would kind of be trotting up to us at the end of the night. And just and it's really speaks to the power of that of the dog, because when, you know, when you were hanging out with Fred, if you gave him a couple scratches behind the ear or just gave him a pet or played tug of war with him for 5 seconds or 5 minutes, you know, that's what you were doing. And our blood pressure just dropped, you know, and in those moments, you know, no matter how brief, you know, we were home, you know, and we were hanging out with the dog, and it didn't matter when the next mortar would land or when the next patrol was. And it was, you know, that was just a huge advantage for us to be able to have that connection.
So, Craig, how'd you end up in Maine?
Yeah, so when we got the book deal, we were living in D.C. and my girlfriend was working a tech job and I was working a retail job, and we really had just kind of had it both had enough of the city life, and I had always just kind of been endeared to Maine from our the only time I'd been was on the way to Afghanistan, and the people at the airport in Bangor were just incredible. And
the troop greeters.
I want to go back up there. Maybe we could do a book signing up there. That would be really special. Because I'll never forget the faces. And so when we got the book deal, we kind of looked around on Airbnb and different, you know, places for a winter rental. And we found this place in Sullivan that was actually built by a World War II veteran. And we contacted them and they put us up for the winter. And we've been hooked ever since. And now we live in Cape Elizabeth, just outside of Portland. And we're doing another winter rental this winter while we kind of feel out the different areas and kind of explore. And I'm hoping to sell my house in D.C. and we can buy a place up here soon. So, yeah, we just, you know, it's a funny thing because we don't have any connections up here. We don't really have, you know, any family or anything like that. But we feel like we do at this point. You know, we've been here a couple of months and our neighbors are incredible. And everybody that we've met has just been incredible. And Maine just seems like this really big community. It doesn't feel like a state. It feels like everywhere you go, you know, you can talk to people and people are.
It's,
you know,
one big neighborhood.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's really cool.
So what's next for you?
Yeah, so we're gonna keep traveling. We're gonna be headed to Florida in March. We have some events down in Florida, and so we're gonna be kind of doing little stops on our way down and on our way back up between here and there, and then this summer we want to do a big cross country tour again. We want to I want to reunite Fred with as many of the recon guys as I can, and most of them live out west. And so we'll probably be in Denver, Colorado in June, and then we'll head out to California and go work our way up the coast again and just, you know, just see the country and bring our book with us and put as many Fred Paul print stamps in his books as we can we want to meet people and we want to continue to share our story. And one of the things that I'm really excited about is hearing other people's stories and highlighting, you know, all the amazing ways that dogs, you know, rescue us every day. And then also the awesome people that, you know, that are working on behalf of veterans and animals across the country. You know, that's a really kind of a fun thing. We have a lot of fun on social media and you know, so we're excited about what's next.
Well, Craig Grossi, it was such a pleasure to have you with us today. Craig Grossi, an 8-year veteran of the Marine Corps, recipient of the Purple Heart, and Georgetown University graduate. He's the author of Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Tomorrow on the program, Understanding and Treating Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.